Could we start with your background? I thought you'd tell me a little bit about your family and your parents, grandparents, where they came from and settled, et cetera.
Well, my parents were both from Sweden. I came to Minnesota in the 70s. Both very young, and lived there till I died. I was born in Minneapolis, so.
What year were you born?
All the way back, 1897. I was 81 the other day.
They were actually already married when they?
No, they both, I think they were both under 20 when they, okay. I've got my baby here, and...
But they knew each other in Sweden?
No, not at all. No, my mother had a brother and a sister or someone who came to Minneapolis. She stayed in New Jersey a while and then came on to Minneapolis. And my father came just planning to stay a few months and never went back. He was not one who came to... And what I was quite interested... The fact that way back in those days, Minneapolis, the YMCA had a school, and after he had died, I found these little books where he'd gone to take English and transcribe the Swedish words over the English. Oh, he went to the YMCA school and learned English, and I believe bookkeeping.
Oh, and what did he do?
Well, eventually, when he first came, he was just a boy, and the only thing he knew how to do was drive horses. So he found a job where he could... take care of horses for a man, but then he got into business gradually for himself, helped a cousin who was a builder, and then he got into real estate for the rest of his life.
Did your mother work when she came?
Yes, she worked, about all there was to do was domestic work, mm-hmm. And she was somewhat of a bossy kind, so she worked at that for a while, and then she helped someone with a little store. There weren't too many things for women in those days. If she wanted her mother to live with her.
How much education did each of them have?
Well, they had whatever the elementary, but I think in many ways they probably were better educated as they got older than lots of people in more formal schooling.
So both of them received their education in Sweden?
Yes, more or less. My father did went to school a good deal in Minneapolis at the YMCA school. I didn't know that. They existed that far back then.
And how old were each of them when they came?
They were both slightly under 20. I don't remember. They were 18 or 19. And
but they had already been out of school in Sweden before.
Yes,
they
my father would have had to go into the military service the following year, and he came over to visit cousins in Michigan, and he went down to visit a cousin in Minneapolis with all intentions of going back because. They had a good deal of land, and his parents had died, and he should have gone back as the oldest son, but he never did.
Oh, and so his parents actually just stayed in Sweden?
They were dead when he came.
They were both dead when he came?
Yes. His father, his mother, and his oldest sister died in a period of 7 months.
Oh, from some sort of epidemic?
No. His mother died of pneumonia, which was a killer then. His father went hunting and never came back from the trip. And the older sister apparently... From what I've been told, had something that sounds like infantile paralysis today or rheumatic fever or something. But that's not anything to do with my women's bureau, is it?
Now, your mother worked as domestic until they married?
I guess so. Just I think most of the time she also worked in this little store.
And then were you the firstborn?
Yes, the only one. I have just one brother who's 12 years younger than I am.
And when you were growing up, what was the atmosphere like in your household in terms of education and reading and the kinds of values in the household?
Well, my mother was a sort of person who started up in this corner of the newspaper and read to the very, they both read English well by that time. And into her dying day, she couldn't understand why I didn't read the newspapers. I'd come home and she'd say, well, don't you read the papers? I said, yes, but I don't read the Minneapolis papers. Well, you must see it in some paper. No, she was very quick. That is a picture of her and my father. That's all right. Well, that's my fault. It doesn't matter. Well, then.
I was interested in the general environment in your home, what your own expectations were for yourself as you were growing up as a young girl.
I don't think I had any. Did most of us do?
Well, I found a wide range.
I knew that we were comfortable enough, so if I wanted to keep going to school, I could go as long as I wanted to, and that was about all. And
there was no question but that you would be able to, and that as a girl, there'd be no limitations.
Oh, no. Oh, heavens, no. Not with my mother. And it was just, they would ride if I wanted to go to school. I'm sure if I hadn't wanted to go, I probably would have. That would have been all right.
But so as you were growing up, did you have ideas about what you wanted to do?
Yeah.
No? Oh, that's interesting, because so many of the women in your generation especially, invariably what we found is that they expected to be a teacher, and that they were going to go to normal school and be a teacher from a young age.
For some reason, I don't think I ever thought too much about being a teacher. And I thought I wanted to do something else, but I wasn't just sure what it was. And I probably would have changed my mind very easily.
So,
when you came out, it was about the only thing there was to do.
You know. As you went to high school, you still didn't have any definite plans?
No, I was... I know you mustn't get tangled up with that. No, I didn't have any special. Just kept going.
And did you go from high school into college?
Yes.
Where was that?
I went to the University of Minnesota, and then I was out 2 years, and then I went to the University of Chicago.
Oh, so you went to the University of Chicago when Breckenridge and were there.
I lived in Green Halls and sat at Breckenridge's table several years. Seasons.
Now, what year was that? That you got your bachelor's at Minnesota?
Sullivan, and then I got my master's at Chicago.
And at that point, when you went to Chicago, did you have plans to be a social worker or something?
No.
Just wanted to...
No, I thought then I'd go into business probably or something.
Oh.
I didn't know what. Banking.
How did you happen to pick the Chicago thing?
Well, I was looking over the graduate schools, and I went in and I decided that Chicago was... I was considering either the Wharton School of Finance or... the University of Chicago and the Economics and Business School. I was there in the days of Nellis and Douglas and, Keep Still, a good group. Mm-hmm.
Now, wasn't Abbott there too?
Oh, yes. They both, Miss Abbott and Miss Breckenridge, both lived at Green Hall, and I spent a year in Green Hall.
Now, was this a residence?
Yes, it was one of the residence halls at the university.
But they had close contact with the students?
Oh, yes, because we all ate together, don't you? I had three meals. And I sat at Miss Brickinger's, head at a table. And she was trying to convince me I wanted to do social work. And I didn't think I did.
Now, I'm trying to think what year that was. If Olive Stone would have been there about the same time you were or not. Does that name sound familiar to you? Olive Stone?
Oh, yes. But I didn't know her then.
Oh, she died just... about a year ago, but she was at the University of Chicago about
yes.
the same time.
Yes, I know she was.
I did several hours of interviews with her for the University of North Carolina Southern Oral History Program.
Mm-hmm.
And I know she was there just about, maybe
not
slightly
that time,
later
yes.
than you were.
Maybe just a little. And Ruth Redeker, I didn't know her till later. She was there, and she was in unemployment insurance, and older.
Now, it's interesting, you know, it never even dawned on me that the Bureau, that many of the women in the Bureau were influenced from that whole University of Chicago group of women. Were there others who came out of it?
No, I don't think so. Not at the, Miss Anderson, of course, had come from Chicago, but I didn't know her. No, I was, had all my credits for my doctorate except about seven, and I'd had my, and I was getting sick of it, just thought I'd like to get out. And I just saw an ad, there was to be this examination for the Women's Bureau. And so I wandered down to the post office in Chicago to see if I could take it, because that was a federal building. And they said, oh, you had to file an application. I said, oh, well, then I won't take it. Oh, well, very few are going to take it. Why don't you come in? I think there were three or four of us that took the exam.
And what was the exam for exactly?
A field worker, I don't know what they called it. Another time, an investigator or a field worker.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was before you went to Los Angeles to teach them?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, so you took the exam and just hadn't heard?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, because I didn't even file a preliminary application. Nobody told me when I went down to take the exam that you had to file a preliminary. So I just took the exam and passed the paper in and left. And then I got a letter, I guess after I got to California from Miss Anderson, asking, she'd seen Paul Douglas or somebody and said I was on the list. Or did he know I hadn't taken the exam? No, it was the Children's Bureau, too. And what list was I on? Well, I wrote civil service, and they said, I wouldn't be on any list until I filed an application. I'd taken an exam, but I hadn't filed the application.
Tell me a little bit more about the atmosphere at the university with Breckinridge and Abbott and all the other very involved women. Was there a group of women students who were close to them? Was there any kind of ongoing discussions or organization at all?
Through YWN, not too much. I wasn't in their department. You see, they were social work.
Mm-hmm.
I was just happened to be living in the hall. I was in economics, but just sitting with them. They got to know I was rather interested in labor and problems that came up, and I used to go down to some of the labor meetings on Sundays at the Central, the Consul in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they called it, and I'd tell us. Miss Breckinridge was always very interested if I'd been to one of those, and she'd tell me about people and so on.
Now, how did you happen to get involved in the labor, being interested in labor to begin with? Do you have any sense of that?
No, not particularly, just because it was one of the problems any of the day. You saw working people having a hard time, you heard of the unions and so on. I was just interested as a social factor. Because my father never belonged to a union, so I didn't.
Did Douglas play any role? Next, I know he was very closely tied to the Amalgamated, especially.
Who?
Paul Douglas.
Yes, well, he was, he was very interested in labor and all of the factors, and Paul Millis was very interested in labor unions and the union angle, and so they were quite different. One was very much the practical matter of Millis, mm-hmm. and Douglas was more the dreamer and the planner and the a much wider philosophy of the labor field generally, probably.
Mm-hmm. But the department itself then really was very involved and committed to the labor movement, it sounds like.
You mean in Chicago?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they kept very close to it, but not, I don't think, involved in any way.
Mm-hmm.
It was just that they were observers, not, and I remember Douglas gave a course in the isms. I don't know, that was lots of fun. And that I was just floating around. I wasn't being pushed. And I didn't.
You took your exam, you then decided that you weren't going to finish with your degree, though.
No, I decided not to go back. I'd written my introduction to my thesis and all.
What was it going to be on?
The administration of the workman's compensation law in Illinois. And then I was going to do five. I did that part, and I got by for my master's. Then I was going to follow up 500 cases, either by visiting some of them. I didn't know about home visits in those days, but Mr. Millis wanted me to try to get out and visit maybe 100 of the people and or more of the cases that we selected. But I did the first part, but never got to the human angle. But I don't think that concerns you.
Were there many women going to their doctors in economics?
No, not too many in those days, no. Oh, there probably were if you took the country as a whole, but not very many in Chicago at that time.
Did you have any problems as a result of that?
No. What sort of problems?
In terms of not being a very supportive climate for a woman to pursue her doctorate.
No, I don't think so. No, I think both Millis was said why he was quite surprised when I announced I wasn't coming back for next year, that I just decided maybe I'd had enough. I think part of it was I first thought maybe I couldn't get one, and after a little while I wasn't so sure that it was so impossible, and like a lot of them today, I just thought I'd had enough of school. And I don't know that I ever regretted it.
Did you ever feel it held you back not having gotten it?
Am I?
Did you feel it held you back at all not having gotten it?
No.
So you, after taking the exam, had you already planned when you took the exam to be coming out to California?
No, a friend was going out, so I just joined her, and I stayed home that fall, and wondering what I was going to do, and I was going to look for a job, but hadn't too gotten too interested in it, and she was going to California, so after Christmas we took off, and I decided I wanted a job, and I had a job offered in one of the banks, but that was really quite funny. I was at a small hotel, I've forgotten the name, and the man who was there was an employee. Oh, he thought that he'd done very well. He could get me a job at $1,500 a year going to bank because I had a background in business. And I went down, looked it over, and didn't like it so very much, so I went down to see if I could get a job teaching because I'd taught in Minnesota for a year and a half. And so...
after having done your BA?
I guess in between. And so, and then I worked for the YW for a short time.
Which YW was that?
Minneapolis. And I had considered whether I wanted to go on to the national board and become a YW worker, and I decided I didn't want that either.
So then you taught for a year in Los Angeles?
Well, really, I got out there. Began teaching in January and taught through that semester, and I came on here. I still had my contract to teach and to go back, and I kept it till I'd been in the Bureau a month or so. I knew they'd have no trouble filling.
Now, what were your expectations about what your work would be in the Bureau? What do you think some of your own ideas were of what you could do there?
Not very many. I didn't think very much about it. I was as curious as to a job, and it I was... I'd gotten slightly interested.
Were you familiar with the work at the Bureau?
No. I'd never heard of the Bureau.
Oh, when you applied when you took the test?
No. No, I'd never, an assistant director came out. Well, I was teaching when I got, was offered this job, and I was planning to go on to Alaska that summer, I had urged. And when this wire came from Miss Anderson offering me the job, well, I'd had a letter earlier from Miss Abbott saying that I was on the Women's Bureau list, but the Children's Bureau was also taking people, and they could take them off the Women's Bureau list. So when she asked Miss Anderson, and Miss Anderson, maybe they'd better offer me a job. Not that I was any good, but...
the job was what?
I don't remember what they called us. Field investigators, I guess they called
it. And so from the very beginning, you were hired on...
As a field worker.
Field work.
Yes.
And what did that mean initially when you first joined the Bureau? What kind of work did that mean?
I mean, how much did it pay, or how much it... No.
Well, and also exactly the kind of responsibilities and actual...
Well, you went out with a field supervisor. I went to Delaware. We made many state surveys in those days, and Delaware was very far, and we were interviewing women and just making a general survey of Delaware with special emphasis on canning and preserve, canning. Delaware used to be a great tomato canner. I don't know whether they still can tomatoes, and primarily... That was the big crop, some corn and all. And I'd only been here, I guess, less than a month when we took off for Delaware.
Oh, and you took off with another
Caroline person? Manning. And she was the supervisor.
And usually the studies were designed by someone else, like Princess Mary Elizabeth and them.
Well, no, the field supervisor, well, we almost had a plan that, it was a study of wages and hours and working conditions. And Miss Anderson, having been a worker, felt we should always have some grassroots contacts with the women, so we usually went out and did home visits to her. But on the Delaware study, for the first time, I think that was one of the first where we got interested in something of the women's family and their responsibility. So we were not only interviewing the women as to what they did and their wages, we were getting payroll records and hour records, and then we were talking to women. And actually, we did some of that on the job. Miss Anderson, the director, was horrified because we were taking employers' time. We were just going along talking to them as they worked. I remember just running from one to the other in a large tobacco factory at that time, rolling scars, hand job, hand rolling and stripping and bunching. You bunched and you rolled and you packed.
Well, and that was such a quiet job that I gather you were able to talk to them on the job.
Yes, I think the first time I went into a factory was a silk mill, but by that time I was allowed to go alone. And I came back and wrote the schedule up and made a great deal of all the noise, in a silk mill. And Caroline Lipnick and Caroline Manning, we got to be very good friends. She said, use your textile noise. I said, are they that noisy? Well, she said, I will admit a certain one was a little noisier than some of the others. I just was overwhelmed, you know, with the clatter and the noise.
This was your first experience going into an industrial setting, I gather, wasn't it?
Yes, I'd been interested, so I'd wandered around and gone through factories before, and just out of curiosity. Mm-hmm.
How did the women who you were interviewing on these, especially the home visits, how did they react to the interest that the Bureau took in them?
Oh, I think they were indifferent, and some of them refused occasionally, not many. But most of them had never heard of the Bureau and probably forgot 5 minutes after we talked to them. But lots of them were willing to talk, I think probably more than they would be today.
Mm-hmm.
Because there weren't so many interviews and so much publicity. It was something different.
Now, how long did you work with the supervisor?
Well, I don't mean before I went out as a supervisor, several years, and then I was trusted to go out off on my own.
So when in the field work, usually there was a supervisor?
Oh, yes, usually a supervisor with agents.
And how many field interviewers would there be then?
You mean how many workers were dependent on what we were doing?
Uh-huh.
Maybe two or three of us. Sometimes we'd have larger parties where we'd actually hire people off the civil service list and bring on extra workers just in the locality. To work, and then if it was a survey of that the whole Bureau was involved in, why, our field staff was never very large. There never were more than 9 or 10.
Well, because I keep seeing the same names over and over.
Yes, there weren't so many.
How large was the field staff?
Oh, I can't ever remember it being more than 10 at the most.
Uh-huh. And with the same group of the people all over the country, too?
Yes.
And then, for instance, what the usual pattern would be, how many on the average, would you say?
Oh, there wasn't any really pattern, because again, it depended so much of what we were doing and who was available and what the demands were. You see, the Bureau was small and they had to adjust to the demands and what they had. And I think in those days there were more requests for surveys than they were ever able to agree to make. And Sanderson would try to portion us out. And I was only about, I'd only been in the Bureau a couple of years when we made this survey at the request of the Women's Party, the very, you know, the effective labor legislation.
Effective labor legislation on
women's employment opportunities. Well, then everybody in the Bureau went to work on that, and some of the people were taken out from the clerical force to go along and help. So we had extra field people that worked for the Bureau, but were not regular field workers. And I worked in California on that, and also New England and various places.
Let me ask you more about that, because that whole area, I think there's so few documents left. I know from the labor women that I've interviewed, one of them attended the Women in Industry Conference in 1925 when there was the big blow up.
Oh, yes, when Doris Stevens and
were
her...
Were you there?
I was
Could
there.
Could you describe the conference?
Well, I don't remember that. I recall it, but because I was just... it was about, you see, I'd only been there a year. I'd come in and... you want to be put out? Yes. You be quiet. Well, anyway, women were called in from all over the Sandersons. It was just to be a general Bureau conference, as I remember, to begin with. But it was one of the big first ones, and we had we met down in the old museum of what is now the, it's a museum that's on Constitution, the Natural History Museum.
Yeah.
They always had a little auditorium, and it's been much enlarged, but it was there even in those days. I can put her out.
Oh, I mean, she's not, unless she wants to go out, she's not bothering me.
She's probably demanding attention. And they were invited from all over, and quite a program. Well, the Women's Party stormed the conference. All again, protective legislation.
Had they refused to come?
Yes, I think they had at first. Or whether they hadn't, I'm not even sure whether they were invited. Alice Paul and Doris Stevens, and I can still see some of them. I've forgotten the names, but I do remember Douglas Stevens.
Who?
Yeah, it was
Pollitzer.
Yes, she was one of the or a lady like Alice Paul, you know, just shrieked even in those days.
Oh, the reason I, in 1923, the only record, see, I was looking for the records of that 1925 conference and couldn't find them. In 1923, there was the Women in Industry Conference, and there was an exchange. I don't recall if I had Xeroxed and brought it with me or not. Where in the proceedings, someone asked from the floor if the National Women's Party had been invited, and Mary Anderson said, obviously had been anticipating this, and brought with her the correspondence which she read, which was the Bureau's reply to the invitation that unless they were allowed to speak, they weren't going to come, that they didn't feel that their point of view was going to be represented. So that she then wrote back, saying that the speakers had not been invited according to organization. She hoped they would reconsider. But it was clear reading between the lines, the fact that she had the letter there waiting, that even in 1923 she was expecting trouble.
Yes, oh yes, and you see this
and
was true.
And Powell was the one who replied to the letter, which is how I knew.
Yes, and 25, well, it ended up with a big evening meeting at which they were allowed to present their side of the case, aren't we? I remember we met at night, and I still remember Doris Stevens in this brilliant red silk dress. Oh, very much making an appearance.
So their confrontation was to insist on being heard. Was that
yes,
the point?
Mm-hmm. And you see that the program had already been drawn up, and they were not on the program. As I remembered, I thought they were allowed to come, but they were not given a place on the program because the the direction or the emphasis was on protective legislation for women in the various states and what had been done. It was reporting of the various states by areas and the women from the labor organizations who in those days were very interested in protective legislation and state administrators and so on. And the Women's Party really wasn't a part of that. But they were allowed to attend if they wanted to, but not to take a part. But then they were allowed to have this meeting at night.
And that was a specially arranged meeting?
Oh, yes, after the conference began, after this, after they stormed up and...
How many, they actually stormed the microphone?
Well, there weren't microphones in those days.
The platform,
yes. Uh-huh. Oh, yes, a shriek, Alice Paul, that I can remember her going down the aisle, just shrieking.
What sorts of things were they shouting?
Oh, I don't know, that we're going to be heard, you know, or something like that, so we have a right to be heard, this is a women's conference, and so on, and the woman who was president of the temperance union in those days, the women's took over and more or less laid them out. And then Mary, the University of Chicago Settlement, she's been dead a long time, Mary somebody. McDowell, yes. She also rose to defend Miss Anderson. And,
it became a personal attack.
Well, on the Women's Bureau. Uh-huh. Miss Anderson represented the Bureau, don't you? And these other organizations. And then some of the men who'd come all rose. So they were really acting, you know, it was a demonstration.
How many of the women from the Bureau, from the Women's Party were involved? Do you recall? Was it just the three?
No, there were more than that, but not too many. It wasn't a very large organization. Mm-hmm. I don't think they even had Belmont House in those days. That came later.
That's the one on Lafayette Square?
No, that's the one up on the hill.
Oh.
That's up there, very near, back in the Library of Congress, as I remember.
Oh.
Back in there, it was the Belmont House, and it was given to the Women's Party, and I think they still own it. They might even have records up there.
I'm not sure.
Miss Anderson didn't have any great antagonism. It was just that she was very dedicated to the idea that legislation was one of the ways of gaining things for women.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought these were more or less just, middle-class freaks who really didn't know the working women. They were not. There were very few working women that belonged. There were a few, I'm sure, as the time went on. But at the beginning, there were very few, and they were just the... the far left gang of the suffrage group, and the ones who were shrieking, and it was a very noisy business. I know they disrupted that afternoon meeting, and I was.
And after they demanded to be heard, right at that moment, was the decision made to have the special night meeting?
No, I think Miss Anderson and some of the people who were, went off, and I don't know whether the meeting was that night or the next night, but it was during the conference that they would have a meeting to be heard, and they could those for legislation and those against it would speak, and there were both men and women.
So it basically took the form of a debate on protective legislation.
Or at least as presentation of statements. It had quite a lot of people came to it. It was a...
Oh, who hadn't been at the conference?
Yes, it was an open meeting.
Oh, now how did they all find out about that so suddenly?
Oh, well, I suppose we had newspapers. I don't think we had much. We didn't have radio to any extent those days. But just word of mouth, I guess. Uh-huh. And the labor organizations, and there were quite a few people from the... Because the labor organizations were quite well represented at the meeting. Those are the women that, and the garment workers and the... and so on.
Because one of the women that I interviewed at Lent was there, from the, one of the four women from the Amalgamated.
Well, she was...
I'm not sure who... I know one was Bessie Hellman and Dorothy... Yeah,
Bessie Hellman is dead. And,
yeah,
and
Dorothy Jacobs-Belanco, who's also dead, was there, and then Sarah Rosner, and there was a fourth woman from the Amalgamated, and I can't track down who that was. And I have a picture from Sarah of the, that long, long picture of all of the,
conference.
Delegates standing with Cleveland, and having that picture taken.
Yes.
Not Cleveland, Harding.
Yes, I remember Sanderson had copies of that.
Very, very wide picture.
Yes, pictures.
Now, what was the reaction during, to all of the, first to the shouting, and then by the other delegates of the conference?
Well, of course, I think the one's party was far outnumbered, don't you? People were interested in protective legislation, party. And so they were a small minority at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there was too much feeling. It was just accepted.
Did they seem to win anybody over who was initially in their camp?
I don't... none. There wasn't any, you know, coming up to the altar accepting the new theory. I had always wondered a little bit about how much protected legislation was a good thing, but I went along with it. My feeling more was, well, was it enforced? Didn't you need more general legislation? I think I was glad when the wage and hour law came that applied to all.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there was a time when it probably helped women some, because we saw the difference in, you know, California had a minimum wage rate. And I was working on a laundry study when that was the late 20s. And happened to work a little both in California and Alabama. Women were getting 6 cents an hour in the laundries. Well, they weren't getting less than 25 cents in California. That wasn't any big wage, but it was so much more than they were getting in the non-minimum wage states. And California was one of the states that more or less enforced their minimum wage laws in those days. Pearl and the first woman was very good that was out there.
Was there disagreement among the women in the Bureau themselves about the whole issue?
No, very little. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was just accepted. That was one of our to promote the welfare of wage earning women. In those days, legislation wasn't accepted means or to make the opportunities up.
Did you identify yourself as a feminist?
No.
Did any of the other women?
I don't think so. No. They just worked.
Because you certainly seem to have devoted a lot of energy to women's welfare.
But I don't think they were ever. Real feminists in the sense of, after all, you know, we were from the government, we had to beg for information, get it where we could. we didn't know, the Bureau didn't have any authority to demand pay rolls. They went and got it through their cooperation, but all you could do was report it back that they didn't cooperate. And most of them did, but of course.
Well, do you think that there was an attempt then on the women working for the Bureau not to be viewed as being too partisan?
You mean partisan towards women? No, I think I used to be interested as time went on, watching, young girls that come in and work in the field a while, they'd be quite indifferent. Well, before long, the better ones got very partisan to women's rights, or feeling that women really were getting at the low end of the totem pole, don't you? Well, but they just didn't have any opportunity to be any other place. They were on the low-paying jobs, because they were the unskilled, and of course, they were in and out of the labor market.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter whether it was the office, they were on the lower clerical jobs. If you were in the factory, most of them, there were always a few that got out, but there were very few women supervisors. Most women didn't want women supervisors, and I'm afraid they still don't.
What, did you see a change in the commitment of the women who came into the Bureau to work over, as the years went on? It sounds like that first group was a group that was highly committed to women's issues.
Yes, I think the first group, well, probably a little less as time went on. But we got rather, I think, a group who were interested, they wouldn't take the job, or some of them stayed for a few months and left.
Mm.
It wasn't what they wanted to do. We had some of those. I know the one girl I had in California, I'd taken her out, and I thought we were having very pleasant days. We weren't doing anything but copy payrolls. She'd just come out. I can't remember if it was Berkeley or not. She said, "Well, I'm a college graduate. I didn't come to sit and do clerical work like this." And I said, "Oh, you know, it's very pleasant when you can sit and do things like this for a couple of days. It's a real rest. When you're having struggling to get the information, you know, getting out." Well, she just couldn't. That was much too boring, so I guess she left at the end of 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, did the commitment to helping the wage earning women extend beyond the studies that people did in the work in the Bureau? Did it spill over into their outside activities at all?
You didn't have any outside activities because you moved around so much, didn't you? You know, you just gathered information, went to a hotel room, got some dinner, and wrote reports. You didn't get involved in any work. We weren't allowed to get involved in the community's tech, supposedly we were supposed to.
Oh.
You see, that might have jeopardized our ability to get information from the employer if we'd been out shouting for the rights of women. We merely provided facts, biased as we could. So we never took part in community activities. We might work with the groups, but we didn't actually work on there.
So when you went into it,
in those days,
you'd be fairly isolated, in other words.
Yes, well, you see, that was our basis of getting information.
Uh-huh.
If they'd known we were connected with the labor unions or with the League, I don't suppose the League of Women Voters or any of the women's unions groups, well, we probably would never have been able to get information.
Did that create a hardship for you, that sort of isolation and being set apart like that?
Not particularly, I don't think, because you were busy. After all, you know, you worked all day, you're tired. And you don't know the community. You get around a little, but you didn't stay long enough in most communities to get too involved.
Yeah.
You were getting involved with the employer and trying to get information, because in those days, when I think back, you know, we never did any payroll in any study of wages that we didn't copy the payroll, put down cards. It wasn't, we didn't get just rates from the employer. We went right down and I took them off and the hours worked and time cards and it wasn't always easy to get information from employers. You couldn't tell them that they had to do it. All you could tell them was that, well, all you could do was report them back to Washington. You didn't. You weren't a policeman. You couldn't demand that they give you the information. I can remember many of them. Most of them did. I was surprised when I think back how most of them did cooperate. But occasionally they hated you because if you were in a Democratic administration, they were a Republican. And I remember one who I chased around for days. You know, sometimes you just couldn't get these. You'd have to get permission. You couldn't. Miss Anderson was quite adamant we were not to take information from a bookkeeper or a clerk. We were afraid that might get them in problems, that we had to take it from somebody who represented the firm. Well, sometimes it was hard to. Well, I had chased this man. He had a big cafeteria. And so it was lecture time. He said, "Well, you don't need to worry. Why are you worried?" But he said, "You want to work?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to get this." We picked him. Well, he said, "You'll be out of the job next week anyway. Republicans are going to be elected." And I said, "Well, it really doesn't make any difference to me." I said, "I came in on a civil service job when Coolidge was in." He said, "Why didn't you say that in the first place?" Well, from then on, we were, you know, as stupid as they could be, many of them, to him. They just didn't realize that civil service...
that you stayed no matter who was it on.
It doesn't make any difference. They'd be really quite... I had one man got so mad at his son. His son was vice president because he'd given me permission that he was going to throw his son out of the business. All the time he let me copy the payroll. I was working. He lets you do it. But I'm going to get rid of him. I'm not having the government interfering. I knew he was no good.
But you really did not have any legal authority. There was nothing you could do if they didn't cooperate,
no,
was there?
No, the Organic Act said we could, you know, you could, we were to collect information on all conditions affecting the welfare of working women. But that it doesn't have any teeth in it, really.
Yeah.
You don't know, and there never was a court case. Whether we did have or didn't, we don't know. Those days, people weren't going to court so much. And the whole department was operating more or less on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
And on the whole, you got voluntary cooperation. Every once in a while, there was a blow-up, but...
Now, did you work in teams usually, say in the smaller studies? Was there more than...
Well, it depended on if you were making, we made a large cannery study. I happened to be working in the West Coast. I worked from Washington down through California. Somebody else was working with a group on the East Coast. And you see that most of California has a big concentration of canneries, for, at least for fruit, and but the vegetable canneries on the East Coast, and a group working in Florida. So there probably were, I can remember, about three groups working at that time. I spent my time all on the West Coast working canneries there. I chased canneries from San Diego to Bellingham.
Now, with the same, usually did you work in the same teams, or was it somewhat random how people were assigned?
Oh, it was all random. Mm-hmm.
Was it self-selected, or did Miss Anderson make the assignment?
Well, she more or less made the assignment, and we all worked pretty well together. I can't remember there was ever any, you might have preferences, but
were those usually honored, if possible?
If possible, if the person wasn't needed somewhere else. I had a very close friend. I would do like, I traveled a good deal with her, and we didn't manage to work together very much because she was, I had to go off at one, and she was felt too responsible to be sent out to work with me, so she just was off on something else. I don't know that...
She was a field worker also?
She was a field worker also.
Now, when you would go into a community, you basically remained isolated and then just would relate to whoever else from the Bureau was with you, in other words.
Oh, yes. And that was all. They only two or three, and lots of times you were alone.
That must have been difficult.
Oh, no. You got used to it.
Were you viewed ultimately as having more skills in certain areas? Did each of you develop certain kinds of skills and would be used for specific things?
Well, you see, the Bureau was small, after all. It never really mattered. You couldn't have much specialization.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. I worked about on most anything that came up. You didn't, and there was a turn. There was turnover and changes, so that I was interested. I had had accounting and so on, so if that sort of a thing was involved, there was a chance that I'd be set off on that, because I probably could talk to the employer in terms of costs and bookkeeping and so on, but that was just because I'd had a certain amount of accounting, and it always overwhelmed them when you knew a cost, you know, when you could look at a cost sheet and know what it was all about. But otherwise, no, it was, after all, it was getting information, getting it in form, and getting it back.